Welcome to episode 4 of Speak Beastie for January 31st, 2016.
I'm Shannon Mickelson.
I'm Ariel Taransky.
I'm Aaron Schwartz.
And I'm Claire Ferner.
Welcome to the podcast, Claire.
Hello, guys.
Claire, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm in London. As you might be able to hear, I'm not from the States. And I am one of MuggleNet's senior staffers. What that essentially means is I head up the London team. The London team was, up until about October, a team of one. But we recruited a few people. They're amazing, and they're all based in London. And we basically go out and see shows, films, cover any alumni stuff, but also any upcoming Harry Potter stuff. So whether that's spending far too much time at the studio tour or checking out Mina Lima's exhibition, we've got some good stuff coming up. We're going to the book night, Bloomsbury's book night events. It's a lot of fun, but I sort of help coordinate that lot. And I also happen to be a Hufflepuff.
Yay.
Ooh, ooh. Claire has a much cooler job than us.
Yeah.
Purely location. Yeah. I joined as an intern, and then they're like, oh, Claire, you're like just outside of London. I was like, yeah, I am. Do you want to go to the studio tour on Saturday? And that was 3 years ago.
So gosh.
Okay.
We're happy to have you here with us today, Claire.
I'm good to be joining.
Everything we do sounds so classy now that Claire is just like talking. It's really nice.
Yeah. Basically. We're much better now that you're here.
Oh, of course.
And now for the Phoenix Register. So this week in the news, we have a few things, not as much as last week. We did have an article on MuggleNet.com with a Pottermore correspondent talking about the Fantastic Beasts stunts. So the Pottermore correspondent met with stunt coordinator Eunice Huthert to discuss some of the stunts, especially the ones involving Eddie Redmayne, where he had to be suspended into the air. And luckily, Eddie seemed to be really enjoying it and was game for anything. She said, I have never had to talk him into doing anything. Eddie's just like, come on, guys, what are we doing now? Bigger, faster, harder. It's more a case of me telling him, Eddie, we can't do that. We need to make sure he can work tomorrow, you know? And I just think that's really amazing how game for it he is. And also how, when we'll be watching the movies, we'll know that Eddie's actually been doing most of the stunts himself.
It's like, it didn't occur to me that there would be a lot of stunts, because I guess I just imagine Newt running around with his notebook writing about animals, but I'm like, apparently he's gonna do stuff. And that's exciting.
It does make me wonder at what point he'll be suspended in the air. Maybe he'll be, this is just my theory, but I wonder if he'll maybe be on a dragon or something, because... I don't know. That's just what I'm hoping to see. And we know with the trio in Deathly Hallows, when they were on the dragon, I know they used some realistic effects, but then they also did some CGI. So we don't really know what kind of effects they're going to be doing for this movie. But with the stunts, I'm hoping to see him on a dragon. That's just what I really want to see.
I just want to see a dragon.
Yeah.
The suspending him in the air makes me think of when they kind of, the original series, there was a point where they're falling and Hermione puts like a cushioning charm and they fall onto it. I can't remember where it is.
That was at Gringotts.
That's at Gringotts.
Yeah, so that kind of, yeah, it is, yeah, you're right.
Oh, it's in the Department of Mysteries.
Oh, you're right. That did happen more than one time.
But that's that sort of thing of where he's sort of, he's suspended, so he's falling, I guess, or if he's flying, so maybe someone's levitating him. That would be cute.
Oh, levicorpus.
Yeah. But just the fact that they're saying that he's like so game for it, I think just looking at his most recent roles, he clearly enjoys the physical aspects of acting and how to transform yourself and getting involved in that. I mean, I think even though it didn't look like stunt heavy, his work on the imitation... No, Theory of Everything. I get the two confused. But where he, that scene where he falls over when he first trips and sort of lands on his side, they went into some insanely intricate details to do that stunt, considering it looks like he's just falling over. And I think he got beaten up quite a bit during it. So I think it's clear that he's game for that, which sounds fun. Also, just I read the whole interview with this woman Eunice, and it's insane the quality stunt team people need. Like, my sister was previously training to be a stunt person, and you need to have 6 disciplines in certain areas, and it's an incredibly tough job. So it's cool that she's been going for so long, and they've got such an experienced person involved.
I like seeing a woman stunt coordinator.
Girl power.
I just like the idea of Eddie being like flown up on a cable and him just being like, "Wee!" And they're like, "All right, Eddie, we need to focus now." And, "Oh, yeah. Okay, I'm ready. I'm good."
I'm just imagining the coat just flying, flaring. Yeah. Out. It's looking fabulous.
Oh my gosh. That's
Maybe the coat flies. Any more theories about the coat? Like, I'm for it.
Oh, Newt in his flying coat. Well, how interesting would that be, though, if there were magical... Because we already have brooms that are, you know, magicked into being able to transport people by flight. So what if somebody did that to a coat? It's essentially the same kind of concept.
I guess they had flying carpets, so if they could enchant a coat with the same thing.
I just feel like it would be an awkward ride.
It'd be a bit weird. That coat's fabulous enough without any magical charms.
Well, speaking of coats, we did get a little more information on Colin Farrell's coat, who plays Graves in the films. Or film. We don't really know what's going to happen to his character.
That's true.
Whoops. The Pottermore correspondent spoke with the Oscar-winning costume designer Colleen Atwood to talk about Graves' coat. She said, "Graves is the ultimate wizard, so I wanted to take it to a level of 1920s elegance with a touch of glamour, of fantasy. So I took a coat and I made it a little bit longer. I exaggerated the shoulders and I shaped it a little bit more. Then I made it out of a spectacular piece of cashmere," which sounds really comfortable, side note, "that just kind of moved and had a lot of light. It also had a little bit of lyrics in it. So it catches the light at night and almost looks wet, which I really think makes it stand out from other things. That's where I was going with his character. And then I kind of edged his things so they were very graphic, black and white too, in a way that made him special. So I really appreciate how they did that sort of metallic shimmering look with it. Because in the trailer, you barely see him. I didn't even know it was Colin Farrell until someone pointed out. I just thought it was, oh, there's a guy standing in the building. And so you can barely, if you can't even see his face, you can barely see his coat. So I'm really interested in seeing more about his coat and the importance of coats in this movie as a whole. It's just very exciting. And I like the detail that they put into it.
Yeah, men strutting around in fancy coats is going to be excellent. I think it will all go down very well. My favourite part of this quote, though, is the description of Graves as the ultimate wizard. Excellent. I don't know really what that means, apart from maybe eccentric. But yeah, ultimate wizard. That sounds great.
Yeah, this makes him sound like really cool.
Yeah.
He's what every wizard wants to be.
But the detail they put into these things, I don't know why I'm surprised. Going to the studio tour, listening to them talk about it as a film fan, just generally, you hear production designers talk about the time and effort they put into making everything. But this is one person's coat. It's not even the whole costume. It's just the coat. And there is so much detail and thought and precision into it. It's amazing. It's so cool.
I agree.
Yeah, when I opened this and I saw Colleen Atwood, I was like, of course. There is no other costume designer.
Yeah.
She has like the record for most Oscars won or something like that. Because,
oh really? Wow.
Or like most Oscars won for a woman, because she just wins every year for every movie.
Well, apparently with this kind of detail, it's no wonder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I don't know any other costume designer names, but I know who Colleen Atwood is.
It does ring a bell now I think about it. But
if I was talented in that area at all, that's the kind of stuff I'd want to be doing. That very elaborate, dramatic, but totally awesome costume designing. Because I feel like that's just so creative, and it really gives you, doing all those magical type movies gives you a lot of room to work with and to just have a lot of fun with it. Even with this one item of clothing, the coat, she goes into a lot of detail about it, which is great.
Her credit is insane. She did Edward Scissorhands, and then the next year she did The Silence of the Lambs. And then she did Philadelphia a few years later with loads of other things inside, in between. She's incredible. Is this going to look fabulous? At the very least, it's going to look incredible.
Yeah. If nothing else, we'll be like, good job, Colleen Atwood. Yeah. Those clothes were great.
Aaron is messaging us about power saws.
And... So I've unmuted my my mic now, and just as it like so the people can hear this. This is why I'm not contributing. It's not because I'm not interested. It's because it's absolute insanity. Never mind. Oh, are they? I think they're done. Nope, they're not.
Don't jinx it.
Different saw. This is exciting. Okay, go to the next part. I'm gonna mute again.
All right, bye, bye, buddy. Hope you find
nice
your
talking
dad.
To ya.
Also in the news, producer David Heyman picked up the David O. Selznick Achievement Award at the Producers Guild Awards. So congratulations to David Heyman. Mm-hmm. He also had an interview with Hollywood Reporter talking about more on his experience of revisiting the Wizarding World. And he also reflected on the main differences between working on Potter and Fantastic Beasts. He said the differences are not having to work children's hours, and it's set in 1920s New York as opposed to the United Kingdom in the 90s. So I think that's pretty interesting to have someone who has worked on Potter, other than obviously J.K. Rowling, who can point out these differences and know how this is going to be an entirely different series, yet it's still in the same world. So that's something I'm really looking forward to. There are also some nominations for some of our cast members. Catherine Watterson's film, Steve Jobs, has also been nominated for several awards at the BAFTAs and the Golden Globes. Colin Farrell's film, Lobster, has also been nominated for a BAFTA. And the BAFTAs will take place on Valentine's Day. So, yeah. It's a nice night in with yourself or your significant other. Whatever. If that's what you feel like doing.
With your bottle of vodka. Yeah.
We will be having our BAFTA party regardless of Valentine's Day.
Have some nice little Valentine's treats. In other news, our Neville Longbottom, Matthew Lewis, actually got to visit the set of Fantastic Beasts earlier this month. He tweeted about it and said, "Oh, forgot to say, I was on the set of Fantastic Beasts last week. Spoke to Eddie, and I tell you now, the world of HP, Harry Potter, is in very safe hands." And I just think that's really exciting. And I love how he started off the tweet, "Oh, forgot to say, like,
yeah,
so blasé."
How do you forget that, Matt?
Whoops. By the way, I was on the set.
Yeah, because it was funny because he Instagrammed that he was at the studio tour when he heard the news about Alan Rickman dying. And he very specifically said the studio tour. So it was odd that he then, like, a week later brought up the fact he's on Fantastic Beasts. But I love that the old cast have come in to visit the new cast.
Yeah.
It's cute.
It's almost like a rite of passage. Like, yeah. We're passing the torch to
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it's nice.
Even though you're much older than we are, pretty much.
And an Oscar winner, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Even though Eddie is obviously a very talented actor and very capable, this is a film series with a much larger fan base than I think any of his other films have had. So there are expectations mm-hmm. and hopes, of course. So despite his talent, I can imagine he's worried. And for Matt Lewis to basically say, like, rest assured, everything's going to be fine in his hands, I think that's really nice and really, really supportive of them. I really like that. If you want to check out any more of these articles and news stories, be sure to look at MuggleNet's Fantastic Beasts section.
Cool, and on with the Owlpost, we had a fantastic comment from someone over on Tumblr that we thought we'd read out and have a chat about. But they said, "Hey guys," it was from Scamander Case, who wanted to say, "Hey guys, I'm listening to the third episode of your podcast," so last time's, "and you just talked about that picture of Newt where he's holding a piece of paper. The paper says, 'Fighting Modern Evils.'" You can read it here, and they handedly sent us a little link to the photo. And they also said, "Love the podcast," so thank you, even though I haven't been on yet, but I'll say thank you anyway.
Thank you, Scamander's Case, for doing the job.
Yeah, and we also have a little edit on top of that from our editor, Igor, saying that the scene was the one that was filmed at St George's Hall in Liverpool. So it's quite possibly that, oh no, it's probably not the entrance of the Macusa thingy. I like his very, very technical terms there. So it's probably not the entrance of the Macusa. I'm really gutted because I was in Liverpool the week before they started filming, or the week before they announced it. You know, they were prepping it. I was there the weekend before that, and all the boards were up outside that building. I was like, oh, I wonder what's happening there.
Oh my
God. So infuriating. Although, good excuse to maybe go back one day. But yeah, but the building's lovely. Liverpool is lovely. Very good restaurants. Highly recommended. But yes, Fighting Modern Evils.
Yeah.
This person has, Scamandercase has excellent eyesight. Oh no, you can zoom in. That'll be how they read that.
yeah, the image we were looking at was not as high quality. This is the one like from fantasticbeasts.com.
I'm not going to lie, even when I zoom in, the first thing I notice is the coat.
Yeah.
His lovely face, but mainly the coat. But yeah, Fighting Modern Evils. This must be maybe a leaflet he's picked up from the second Salemers.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. I my
that
not
purple
good
coat again. Oh, is that the coat fabulous. Y'all were talking about? Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I just assume coat, Newt.
But yeah, so second Salemers. Do you think he's past this in the street? Are the people that were behind, are they wizards or are they muggles? Oh, no, sorry. No, Madge. Nah, I'm British. I can say muggles.
That's right. Dang it.
Maybe they're some second Salemers and he had to get through them.
They don't look very angry. They kind of look like they're just chilling, waiting to hear something.
And there aren't usually... There aren't usually big crowds like that, so there's got to be a reason for there to be a crowd. But yeah, they don't look like they're protesting.
Mm. But he's running. So this is something that was raised last week, and I think someone said it was a press conference or something. It looks like he's running. They're just kind of there, a crowd mingling, and he's legging up the stairs to deal with something. And maybe they've thrust that leaflet into his hand.
I do see couple guys on the right here look like they could be holding leaflets too.
Yeah. Actually, there's quite a lot of purple in this picture. Do we know anything about the Second Salemers costumes and whether they wear purple?
I don't think so, but maybe they wear purple.
Because that guy with the leaflet looks like he's got a purple ribbon around his hat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was noticing that. And then some of the women behind look like their hats are purple.
Yeah.
I hope they don't ruin purple like they did with pink for Umbridge. That's my color.
Aaron has pointed out that purple equals evil, just like lime green in Disney.
But I'm not evil, so try to explain that one, Aaron.
It's also royalty. Allegedly. And people are trying to like make themselves more self-important, I guess. But then purple, mm-hmm. we've also come to know is quite a magical color.
Yeah.
In Potter.
So yeah, Aaron.
Now Aaron has sent a winky face.
This is really solid podcasting when one of the main hosts is Skyping.
And now Aaron's saying.
Yeah, I love the idea of you guys like saying whatever I'm contributing. So I'm podcasting by proxy.
I was just looking at the filming at St. George's Hall. There was some stuff that was like a party. This looks daytime.
Yeah, I thought it looked like a party when they from the images I saw, but this is definitely not a party.
Yeah. But then you have to take into consideration the whole movie magic thing. Sometimes they just like the exterior, and then they'll use a different interior for different purposes. So,
yeah.
Who knows?
You know, maybe they go there multiple times. They were filming there for quite a while.
I think just
multiple scenes.
Yeah, I think on Igor's comment about it probably not being the Macusa, the people do look like they are muggles or no Madge. And I think the photos from the shooting in Liverpool also didn't look particularly wizardy. They had sort of just muggle dress, you know, 1920s fashion.
Not blue coats and waistcoats.
They didn't look like the ultimate wizard with his fancy shiny coat. But yeah, I think it's interesting.
How do I blend in with the muggles? I'll make my coat look shiny.
Okay, I think there's a little bit of a lull. They're still working, but they have only one saw going, so I think I'm going to go for...
Go
the main
for it.
Discussion.
Awesome.
Okay, moving into our main discussion, an intro to Fantastic Beasts, a brief history of Muggle awareness of Fantastic Beasts. Actually, many Muggles knew about a lot of Fantastic Beasts, which makes sense because we see a lot of dragons and phoenixes and griffins and that kind of stuff in medieval artwork and mythology and that kind of stuff. So a lot of Muggles knew about Fantastic Beasts, but it was decided at one point, well, maybe they should be hidden. Specifically, in 1692, there was a summit. It was 7 weeks of discussion between wizards of all nationalities. And at the end, 27 species, ranging in size from dragons to bundimans, were to be hidden from Muggles.
So, didn't it say that everyone agreed except the goblins?
Yes, because the goblins are always trolling and being... They're just... goblins, come on. That's the... I recently watched the first Harry Potter movie, and it's just such a funny actor talking about how goblins are so, you know, trolling and everything, that when Hagrid and Harry walk in and Hagrid's like, oh, watch out for the goblins, you know, they can be really tricky and clever. It's like he's really saying, hey, they're going to be total tools if they get the opportunity. So, like, all of history says that they're going to be tools. So, yeah. But from the summit of 1692, we got the Clause 73 of the International Code of Wizarding Secrecy, which states each wizarding governing body will be responsible for the concealment, care, and control of all magical beasts, beings, and spirits dwelling within its territory's borders. Should any such creature cause harm to or draw the notice of the Muggle community, that nation's wizarding governing body will be subject to discipline by the International Confederation of Wizards. So now we have an actual law that says, hey, keep your beasts and such in check, or else we're all going to be mad. Yep.
We're going to wag our fingers at you.
I thought it was interesting that they're like, we're not just hiding wizards. Like, we really need to hide everything magical. And they had to sit down and figure this out.
I'm a little disappointed that Aaron didn't include the part about the Jarvie, because that's my favorite.
Oh, I totally skipped over that. I'm sorry. Well, it makes sense that that they would have to hide magical creatures, because it starts to make Muggles question their reality and question everything around them, such as with the story of a ferret mistaken for, or a Jarvie mistaken for a ferret. There's an excerpt in Fantastic Beasts, the book, saying, today, while traveling in the herb garden, I did push aside the basil to discover a ferret of monstrous size. It did not run nor hide as ferrets are wont to do, but leapt upon me, throwing me backwards upon the ground and crying with most unnatural fury, get out of it, Baldy. It did then bite my nose so viciously I did bleed for several hours. The friar was unwilling to believe that I had met a talking ferret, and did ask me whether I had been supping of Brother Boniface's turnip wine. As my nose was still swollen and bloody, I was excused vespers. So it starts to really mess with Muggle life in general when you have magical creatures that are talking to you and other Muggles don't believe it, and how to deal with all that. It makes sense that wizards would be like, oh, okay, this is starting to get a little bit out of hand.
And it also just talks about, like, the Muggles are a little bit stupid sometimes. Like, how did they not realize this is a Jarvie? Gosh.
I just think Jarvies are so great.
I know.
Sounds so... like the Jarvie liked being with the Muggles and was kind of just protecting his own, almost manipulating them.
It's sad. Evidently, our Muggle friend had unearthed not a ferret, as he supposed, but a Jarvie, most likely in pursuit of its favorite prey, gnomes. So, that poor monk was mistaken for a gnome by a Jarvie, and then got called Baldy. So, yeah.
I like that that Newt calls him our Muggle friend.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you.
Very, very inclusive, or attempt to have an inclusive term there.
Yeah. Note that Newt only ever refers to Muggles as Muggles, not nomadges, so...
Take that.
Yeah. America. So after they decided to put all of the beasts into hiding, the next section of the book describes how they were hidden, because that's a little bit difficult. It starts off... The section is called Magical Beasts in Hiding. And it starts off with this little story about how it's not so easy to keep them in hiding. And it's the Ilfracombe incident. I think that's how that's pronounced.
I would agree with you.
So, the Ilfracombe incident of 1932, when a rogue Welsh green dragon swooped down upon a crowded beach full of sunbathing muggles. Fatalities were mercifully prevented by the brave actions of a holidaying wizarding family, who were subsequently awarded Orders of Merlin First Class. They immediately performed the largest batch of memory charms this century on the inhabitants of Ilfracombe. And I'm like, that's amazing. I love that story.
Wait. It's impressive as well.
Okay, it's saying fatalities were prevented because they used memory charms.
I was a little confused there.
Yeah, like when you first started reading that, I was thinking, oh, they must have somehow, like in the Triwizard Challenge with the dragon, maybe they did something to the dragon with his eyes or some.
They must have.
Yeah, they must have done more than just a memory charm, like, look away, muggles. Don't pay attention to this thing in the sky, because it said it swooped down on the muggles, and they were very vulnerable, so
I'm hoping more was done. There's a footnote that says, in his 1972 book, Muggles Who Notice, which I want to read this book, Blenheim Stock asserts that some residents of Ilfracombe escaped the mass memory charm. Quote, to this day, a muggle bearing the nickname Dodgy Dirk holds forth in bars along the south coast on the subject of dirty great flying lizard that punctured his Lilo.
Amazing.
I don't know what that is.
I don't
know. Lilo. It's like an inflatable, you guys definitely have these, inflatable, oh my gosh, there's like bath bed things you take in the sea or in a pool.
I thought it was something inflatable.
Like a raft? Or
They kind of look a bit more like a bed. They've got like a cushiony bit and a mattressy bit. Okay. What do you guys call them?
A floaty mattressy thing? I don't know.
I just call them floaties.
Floaties?
Learn how to spell
floaties, I believe he means. Yeah. There we go.
Yeah, I just call them like an inflatable raft.
Yeah.
Because there's the rings, floaties. There's the ones that are shaped like things. Like I saw a donut one and like a pretzel one that I thought was really cool.
Aaron says in all caps, it's stressful over here. Just so the audience knows.
Doesn't excuse misspellings.
So floaties are definitely different things in the UK.
This 1932 incident, that's not very far away from the first Fantastic Beasts movie. Could it possibly come up in a later movie?
Ooh.
It'd be cool to see something like this in New York or in the US, either in this film or in future ones. And it seems like we might get something like that from the new Nomad character, but just where it's something tiny where you could just, an incident would happen, it gets dealt with, and because of lack of communication back in the early 1900s, it wouldn't have been like taken photos of. It would have just happened, and if you didn't wipe people's memories, they would just tell people stories and no one would believe them.
Like Sasquatch. Okay.
Well, so this section goes on to talk about other nations that don't follow Clause 73 very well, and one of them is Tibet, because the Yeti is spotted all the time, and the other one is Scotland, because the world's largest Kelpie continues to evade capture in Loch Ness and appears to have developed a positive thirst for publicity. Like, that's adorable.
I love that. That makes me happy. I refuse to believe that the Loch Ness Monster is not real.
It is real, so, like...
No, I know, I'm just saying, like, for those people...
That's what the third movie is going to be, trying to capture Nessie.
That'd be so good.
And he rides the Loch Ness Monster.
Yeah.
I think we've said, you guys have said this before already on the podcast in previous episodes, and it's something that always comes up in Alohomora, but the tidbits where it's not a full storyline, it's not how, you know, Voldemort's rise to power was aligned with Grindelwald's rise to power was aligned with the Nazis, etc. It's just little tiny tidbits of the Yeti. It just doesn't elaborate on it. It's just, oh yeah, in Tibet, the fact you see the Yeti all the time, that's the wizard's fault. And same with Nessie, like Lucky Ness. Oh my gosh, you know what I mean. The same in Loch Ness. It's just those little moments that are just great.
I agree. It brings together what people call like folklore into reality. And I really love that, especially when back when we were talking about how dragons and unicorns and all of that were people associate it with the olden days. And as Newt was saying in this book, like they're just allowing muggles to think that was part of the imagination. And I love that with these more quote unquote modern monsters such as the Yeti and the Loch Ness Monster, they're just saying, oh, they don't follow the claws. It's just, let people see them. It's fine. It's a nice nod to all the things that people like to believe in, I guess. Like to go to Loch Ness and try to see, or go to Tibet.
I feel like, aren't Kelpies, don't they have, can't they transform into other forms and stuff? Don't they have like a, I think they can do that, right? Am I crazy? I feel like they're shapeshifters, aren't they?
Yeah, it says, the British and Irish water demon can take various shapes, though it most often appears as a horse with bulrushes for a mane.
Gotcha. Okay, so, the fact that that thing can take different shapes and Loch Ness Monster is classified as a Kelpie, I mean, there are all kinds of different lake monsters all over the world, in, like, Japan and China, North Korea, Iceland as a couple, I think. There's even one in the U.S., the Ogopogo, and, like, the fact that you have, establishing that this is a Kelpie, now it brings in all of the myths of all lake monsters and stuff and says, those are probably all true, which is really fun.
It actually says if you turn the page, the Kelpie description continues to just talk about Loch Ness. And it says the world's largest Kelpie is found in Loch Ness, Scotland. Its favorite form is that of a sea serpent. And then it says see page 38, which is the page that has like the entry for an actual sea serpent. But it goes on to say the International Confederation of Wizard Observers realized that they were not dealing with a true serpent when they saw it turn into an otter on the approach of a team of Muggle investigators and then transform back into a serpent when the coast was clear.
And that is when that's, you know, so Jo was writing that. Otters, she loves otters.
And that's, so it's interesting that it's a Kelpie that looks like a sea serpent, and a sea serpent is an actual creature, but it's not the one in Loch Ness.
Kelpies are like the mystique of magical beasts.
I like the sea serpent entry. It's like, though alarming in appearance, sea serpents are not known ever to have killed any human.
Oh.
Like, okay, if you say so. And a sea serpent has a horse-like head and a long snake-like body that rises in humps out of the sea. So pretty much what you'd expect from a sea serpent. So the introduction goes on to talk about exactly how they keep beasts hidden, because for the most part they're successful. There's just these few big ones that we know about. And the things they have listed are safe habitats for the beasts, controls on selling and breeding. So it mentions the 1965 ban on experimental breeding has made the creation of new species illegal. And then, of course, I think this is Ron's handwriting, has added, but no one's told Hagrid.
Yeah, because he's breeding blast-ended scroots, right?
Yeah.
Idiot. Straight up bad idea. Horrible idea.
He wasn't an idiot. He was just that kid in chemistry class who liked to mix things.
He was just that kid, but he was a grown adult. Doing illegal.
Yeah, he's not an idiot. He's one of my favorite characters, but extremely irresponsible.
And then it mentions disillusionment charms, memory charms, and the Office of Misinformation, which sounds like a great office.
Sounds like a great character name, Misinformation.
And it mentions Loch Ness again. It says the unstinting efforts of this office in persuading Muggles that all photographic evidence of the Loch Ness Kelpie is fake have gone some way to salvaging a situation that at one time looked exceedingly dangerous.
I love that
because I know I'm stuck on Sasquatch, but it mostly has to do with the fact that my father watches all of those Finding Bigfoot shows.
Uh-huh.
And because Jo is so focused on what's happening over on, you know, the other side of the pond, like in Scotland with the Loch Ness Monster, I almost wish there were more mentions of Sasquatch in all of the different pictures and videos and so-called encounters I just think that would have been something interesting to see in this book, because when you mentioned it, there's a lot about the Loch Ness Kelpie. That's what I'm noticing most in this book.
Yeah, she really went out of her way to explain away.
Yeah. Nessie. And I wonder if that has to do with just like her knowledge or experience or whatever on the matter, or if that's just kind of the biggest myth she could think of that was over there.
I think she's writing in Scotland, and I think just in the UK, from my memory, I'd say Nessie, the Loch Ness Monster, is the most well-known of any of those kind of like mythical creatures in the whole of the UK. And she's writing in Scotland, or was writing this in Scotland. So I think that's probably why. And it's just a fun one, because everyone's got their theories. The thing that I thought was quite interesting was the disillusionment charms. Is that on the beasts? So they cast that onto the magical beasts?
I would imagine that they cast them on the area that the magical beast is in, similar to like when the trio is trying to travel around in book 7 and they kept casting, you know, charms to hide them.
Well, it does say those who own a hippogriff are bound by law to enchant the beast with a disillusionment charm. So I guess it is on beasts.
Invisible
probably on
hippogriff.
Like areas too.
How confusing for the poor creatures.
And they
have to be performed daily. The charm.
I also love the idea.
Why would you own a hippogriff?
Because they're adorable and beautiful. Although that could be a reference to, I guess that probably Newt would have mentioned that, because isn't his mother a breeder?
Yes.
So he's going to be aware of that. So he'd know all the laws and restrictions behind keeping a hippogriff, or multiple hippogriffs if she breeds them. Actually, that's a point. I wonder why people do breed, like, keep them. Do they keep them as pets to, like, ride them, like horses?
Maybe.
That's
I guess
pretty cool.
They'd be good like that.
Wouldn't you?
Well, yes.
There we go.
Because you can ride it like a horse or fly it. So it's very functional.
The Office of Misinformation also just sounds terribly, like, 1940s British. Have you ever seen those sort of British slapstick war comedies where they're just like lots of, I can just see these kind of like bumbling office people just like, oh no, that's complete rubbish, not at all. Oh, it's so good. I can just see it. It'd be great.
Well, it says they deal directly with the Muggle Prime Minister to seek a plausible non-magical explanation for the event.
Wow.
So I guess they're just in England. I wonder if there's an Office of Misinformation in America.
Interesting that they deal with the Prime Minister, because the Prime Minister that we see in the Harry Potter timeline only refers to meeting Fudge, doesn't he?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Maybe it's
I guess there's no beast outbreaks.
I wonder if they do a memory charm afterwards, like, well, we've got the problem solved. You don't need to remember this happened.
Yeah.
You don't need to remember there's a dragon on the loose.
So the last little section here is why magizoology matters. And it's just like two paragraphs, so I thought I'd read it all aloud because it's very nice. The measures described above merely hint at the full scope and extent of the work done by the Department for the Regulation and Control of Magical Creatures. It remains only to answer that question to which we all in our hearts know the answer. Why do we continue as a community and as individuals to attempt to protect and conceal magical beasts, even those that are savage and untamable? The answer is, of course, to ensure that future generations of witches and wizards enjoy their strange beauty and powers, as we have been privileged to do. I offer this work as a mere introduction to the wealth of fantastic beasts that inhabit our world. 75 species are described in the following pages, but I do not doubt that sometime this year yet another will be discovered, necessitating a 53rd revised edition of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. In the meantime, I will merrily add that it affords me great pleasure to think that generations of young witches and wizards have grown to a fuller knowledge and understanding of the fantastic beasts I love through the pages of this book.
Aw, good old Newt.
Yeah.
As beautifully as you read
And I'm
them.
Like, you know, the movies are going to come out and more generations will appreciate the beasts.
I read that so well, but I totally heard that in the voice of David Attenborough. Just like, as if he's presenting his latest TV show. It was definitely him.
David Attenborough and Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them.
It'd be really cute if, like, the end of the movie was a voiceover of, like, that section as he's finishing the book.
I wonder if enough people would understand it, though. It would get the reference, so to speak. It's not like a
Other people don't matter.
We want it. Who cares what they think?
So, anything else to add?
Aaron.
To the main discussion. Aaron. He's dead. Well, then we'll move on to our time turner section, which today I figured we'd talk about someone that has been theorized a lot as a possible cameo in Fantastic Beasts. And that is Albus Dumbledore. So Dumbledore was born in 1881, so he will be 45 during the first movie. And I was trying to find exactly, like, when he started at Hogwarts, but I couldn't find an exact date. I just know that he returned to Hogwarts sometime after Ariana's death in 1899, and he began as the Transfiguration Professor, and then he became headmaster in 1956.
The way you worded that made it seem like he went to Hogwarts, like, at 11 years old and began as Transfiguration Professor.
No, he went back to Hogwarts
to
work there.
I was like, damn, Dumbledore. Like, I knew you were good, but...
Hello. But so we have 60 years in there, and I'm not sure at what point he started as a professor, but he did write the preface to this edition of Fantastic Beasts, and he seems well acquainted with Newt, and he talks about this book being a Hogwarts textbook. And so Newt personally asked him to write the preface. And people have talked about, could he possibly appear in this movie or a future movie, either as a Hogwarts professor for whatever reason, or he's in America just hanging out? I don't know.
I don't know if it's plausible for him making an appearance. I think it could be too on the nose, though it could be fun. But I think he taught Newt. I think just the way that we know what we know about people's careers in the Wizarding world, it seems quite linear, I guess. So I think he probably, when he, everything that happened with Ariana and Grindelwald, and he realized, I don't want to go down that route of the Ministry of Magic, etc., etc., I think he was like, well, what do I do next? And I think he probably went back to Hogwarts fairly quickly as kind of, as I need to be, it's something, it's a comfort, you know, it's secure, but also for him, it like keeps him out of harm's way of other people and doing what when he realized he was doing wrong with greater good, etc. But so I think he would have started pretty early in the 1900s, which would have meant Scamander was there. I think Scamander was there from 1908 to 1915, if the wiki is right.
Yeah.
So I think there's a strong possibility he taught him, and then, but they wouldn't have been huge difference in age. I mean, Dumbledore would have been in his 20s then, when Newt was at school. So that's not massive difference. I know people from school who are in touch with teachers who were that kind of age or in relationships. Mm-hmm. Awkward.
So he'd be like...
But no, yeah, so I think it's quite feasible that they could have just got on better when they were at school, when he was a teacher, and then after school they formed a bigger, a stronger bond, more of a friendship rather than a student-teacher relationship.
When you said he'd be in his 20s when he was teaching, I almost wondered, because this is where my mind goes to apparently, if he would be like the hot young professor.
Oh my god.
If girls were like, oh, Dumbledore, in the same kind of vein that Hermione and all of the other girls were swooning over Gilderoy Lockhart. But of course, he was a very, very different character who was vain and very into himself. I think Dumbledore would be more of the, like, the nerdy kind of cute and so focused on school that he's like, I don't care.
Probably a little brooding.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Ah, he's so mysterious. Calm down, Susan. He's your professor.
I think that if we do see Albus Dumbledore in Fantastic Beasts, it has to be like a really small cameo. Like,
yeah.
I don't even think that there would be a flashback to if they went to school together, or if Dumbledore taught Newt. I don't think there would be a flashback of that or anything. I just think that there would be in passing, you see a small exchange at the Ministry or something like that. Because I don't think that you'd want the movie of, or Fantastic Beasts, the story of Beasts, the story of Newt, to be about Dumbledore, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't think that she wants to, like, introduce and be like, oh, here's this more stuff about Dumbledore revealed through Fantastic Beasts, you know?
True.
I think if he showed up in a movie, it wouldn't be the first movie.
You'd save him. I think I'd just like to see a small part that maybe establishes their relationship and why Dumbledore mm-hmm. was the one to write the preface. So maybe that could be.
Although it would be kind of funny to do like a buddy cop movie of Dumbledore.
You know, maybe we just see like Newt delivering copies of the book to Hogwarts. Or you just see Dumbledore in his office opening a package and it's the book. And there's a note like, Professor Dumbledore, I would like you to read this.
Oh,
that's pretty cute. I like that.
Yeah. What do you think?
I wonder who would play young Dumbledore.
Although it'd have to be someone, even though he'd be in his 30s, it'd have to be someone who is older than Eddie Redmayne. So someone in their late 30s maybe looks a bit older.
Well, he'd be in his 40s, right?
Mm-hmm. He'd be 45 if I did my math correctly.
Well, so hang on, Dumbledore's born in 1981. And the film is 1881. Yep, good reading, Claire.
That changes everything.
And the film's set in 1926.
I remember doing this math.
I'm doing the maths now. Yeah, 40?
45.
Yeah,
yeah. But yeah, he still would have been in his 20s when Newt started school.
Yeah.
I wonder at what point people referred to him as Dumbledore, and whether that was. Because the fact that he was a teacher, and by the time we're in sort of the 90s for Harry Potter, most of the people that we meet were taught by Dumbledore, so they would still refer to him as Dumbledore. But I wonder if earlier on in his career, when he hasn't become this person that he is, this sort of esteemed person, whether people just called him Albus. So I think if that's more of the case, I think there could be just a reference in one of the films of a reference to someone called Albus, or you just... saying hello to Albus in the corridors of the ministry, and then it'll be a lot more subtle.
I just saw cool Professor Dumbledore walking into the first day of class and being like, don't call me Professor, I'm Albus.
Actually, I hope he's like, call me Albie.
Call me Albie.
So today in the Newt case, we have the hide behind. The hide behind is mentioned in Fearsome Critters by Henry H. Tryon and Lakeshore Kearney's The Hodag and Other Tales of the Logging Camps, both really cool books, which I believe that you can find in PDFs online if you are interested. Super cool American folklore and funny drawings. And it's also featured in Disney's animated series Gravity Falls in Dipper's Guide to the Unexplained. Very funny episode. But the hide behind is described as 6 feet tall, walking erect, slender body, making it possible to hide completely behind a bole of a 10-inch tree. Long black pelt, curved tail like a French sheepdog, and grizzly-like claws. Practically hopeless to locate its face, if any, and it is impossible to tell if it is coming or going.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's super... It's literally just right behind you. Like,
why do you always pick these ones?
You're welcome.
You give me nightmares.
But, fortunate for many of us, it has an intense aversion to the odor of alcohol. It's never known to attack an inebriate. A bottle of beer was commonly used as a safeguard, so if you got drunk, it's probably not going to come after you.
Now I know you specifically... picked this one to scare me. Oh my gosh, you're the actual worst person ever.
It's good to know that, like, when I'm at my weakest state, it's not gonna come at me.
Yeah, it's safe to get drunk in the woods.
Yeah.
Not
as long as there are no other creatures.
You only won't get attacked by them.
I mean, it'll still be around. It'll still be probably right behind you. But, yeah.
What if I do, like how they do salt circles? I'll do, like, a beer circle? Okay by doing that?
Seems like a waste, though.
I can't
Depending
drink it.
On the beer. Another side note, it does have a taste for intestines, specifically. So its classic move is that it leaps from behind its hiding place, and it's said to kind of laugh and howl, and it disembowels its victim with one swipe.
I'm gonna cry.
some other like descriptions are kind of like the laughing is kind of like a hyena, you know?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's a charming, charming creature.
do me a favor. Next time, pick a really, really happy beast. Just like the happiest one you can find. Just so happy. Like happier than like a unicorn.
A pygmy puff.
Yeah.
Pygmy puff.
Please.
They do nothing.
So the pygmy puff jumps up from behind trees and disembowels
no!
you.
No!
Can you imagine that?
No.
It's like little ball of fur.
It would be a pretty cute death, though, you have to admit. Aww.
Yeah, you're like lying there bleeding out. And you're just like, oh.
It's okay.
Hello, little guy.
He didn't mean it.
Goodness. The hide behind it. When you first started describing it, I thought of like Slender Man.
Mm-hmm. It does have a very Slender Man quality. I don't know if it's actually true, but it feels like the Slender Man legend might have taken some things from this, or might like have some correlations there.
Yeah, because the slender, tall body, the face.
Exactly. There's like no face, and there's like really thin, and it's the kind of it's there and then it's not there quality. Yeah. If you watch Dipper's Guide to the Unexplained in Gravity Falls, the description is similar, or the drawing is very similar to the description, but a little bit different. It actually looks like a very skinny Groot, like from it's a very, very thin, shadowy figure that just kind of follows him around. It's very, very creepy.
So is this associated with any particular location?
I believe Pacific Northwest. I'm not. But the book that it's written in or written about in are like Fearsome Critters tends to go over American like logging areas. So like Pacific Northwest is a big one. So Fearsome Critters is the big one, but then also the Hodag and other tales of logging camps, very similar thing, similar areas.
I wonder if Noodle traveled that way after New York.
It sounded like you said Noodle.
I wonder if Noodle
traveled
that way. So what I call him in private.
I don't know if Newt, I mean, it makes, it, the hide behind isn't in any of the Fantastic Beasts lore or anything, which I guess makes sense because he would have never known.
Oh. That's, and I can't really think of a creature that it resembles at all that's in the book.
And when you think about it, it's likely he wouldn't have been able to find out about it because, one, this was the Prohibition era, and if they're not a fan of alcohol, then I highly doubt that Newt's the kind who's going to drink anyway. And then, if you're not drinking, it's probably going to kill you and eat you. So, if Newt did ever find the hide behind, he would have been a goner. So,
that's probably true, yeah. But Fearsome Critters was written in, or was published in 1939, which isn't too far after Newt is going through all of his stuff. So, there are a lot of critters out and about at that time, so it's possible that there could be interactions, just not disemboweling ones.
But the Prohibition is a good point. The hide behind must be having a lot of fun.
Yeah,
in the 20s.
Go crazy.
So you have to. It sounds like a really great reason for the lumberjacks to break the law.
Yeah,
as a like, I had to drink because the hide behind is around, you know.
Well, obviously, this is the real reason why the Prohibition ended. It was too many hide behind attacks.
Yes.
That's the plot of the third movie. Is there's so many hide behind attacks, and the loot has to stop the Prohibition.
A beer a day keeps the hide behind away.
Did you name the episode again?
Yes, I did. Yes.
Shannon, you're slacking.
I think the episode should just be called, like, construction.
I know. I apologize to the listeners, and hopefully our fantastic editor can edit a little bit of this out. It's really terrible over here. The construction is awful.
Are you sure it's construction and not a hide behind? Right behind you.
That's not fun.
Yeah, no, because I've got a whiskey over here, so I'm pretty confident there are no hide behind.
I forgot about your whiskey.
I've just got a cherry limeade, guys. I'm pretty scared now.
I've just got an empty cup.
But what was in it before?
Water. So.
Okay. Claire, are you okay?
I have empty water.
Oh, gosh.
She's in London. They're not there.
We don't know.
Aren't really hide behinds over there.
Yay. Well, okay, I'm going to London real quick then.
I get a feeling they probably would avoid cities in general because they're surrounded by alcohol. So it's probably why they're chilling in the woods.
So, let's go to New Orleans.
It's fine.
So finishing up today's episode, please send in your news stories and fantastic theories. We'd love to read them and chat about them on the podcast. And thank you very much, Claire, for joining us as our guest host this week.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to coming back soon. And if you guys listening want to get in touch with any of the hosts on Speak Beastie, specifically the three main hosts, you can find them on Twitter and Instagram at Speak Beastie, or over at Facebook at facebook.com/Speak Beastie, or Tumblr, as Scamander Case found us, on speakbeastiepodcast.tumblr.com, and of course, Audio Boom, which is the audioboom.com/channel/speakbeastie, where you can leave a message that might just get played on the show. And don't forget to subscribe to iTunes, leave a review. The more reviews the podcast gets, the more people will be able to see it and find it if they're looking for Fantastic Beast news. We're not far away now, I mean, it's less than a year. So we want people to definitely get involved, get in the hype. But yeah, get in touch, guys.
I'm Shannon.
I'm Ariel.
I'm under construction, Aaron.
And I'm Claire. Case closed.
Igor, he totally put in the dumbest 2 minutes of my life at the end of this last episode, so
I don't honestly know. I haven't listened to
I haven't listened to the most recent one either.
It was the sweat activated shirt conversation. I completely forgot about that, and then I was listening to it with my boyfriend, and I say a lot of things around my boyfriend that is so not Ravenclaw, but he was like shaking his head this time, just, oh, Ariel.
And that's,
I was like,
incredible.
No, I was very tired that day. It's not fair.
Why were we talking about that?
Because we were talking about Newt's clothes, and we said it was like mood changing because of Porpentina's purple coat. That wasn't even in the episode, mind you. And he just inserts that into the end about me talking about sweat activated clothing that does not even exist. And so it's completely out of context, and I just
so nobody knows why.
Yeah, I'm just like, wow.
We should get on the Speak Beastie Twitter and be like, okay, just a PSA.
Look here.
There was a perfectly legitimate reason why this conversation was happening.
It's too late
now.
We
can't explain it in 140 characters, but...
But you have to trust us. We're not that crazy.